harsh of Kiseitse, to borrow a seasonal phrase, is full of mitzvahs like a pomegranate. It has, I believe, the most mitzvahs per parsha in the entire Torah. And so there's, on the one hand, plenty to choose from. And I'd like to open our discussion this evening by referring to one of the very intriguing mitzvahs at the beginning of Kiseitse, and that's the mitzvah of Bensora Umore, what's known as the wayward son, which is in Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Yud Ches, Ki Yele Ish Ben Sorer Umore. There is this wayward son, Einenu Shomer Bekol Aviv Bekol Imo, he doesn't listen to his father, not to his mother, and within the space of a few psukim, it turns out that his verdict is that he's to be put to death. Hey, he steals from them, and we. And pasuk kafalef gamu kol anshi iro ba'avanim ba'meis. As is well known, the Gemara states at least one opinion in the Gemara that there was never really a ben sora umore. There's so many ways that it can not happen that it never really actually happened. But there's certainly a lesson there. One of the curious features of the mitzvah of Bensora Umora, which is mentioned in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, in Daf Peches, the eighth parak of Sanhedrin is actually all about, well, begins about Bensora Umora. It's entitled Parak Bensora Umora. And the Gemara states that, after all, it begins with him stealing from his parents, and to support his habits, he likes fine wine, he likes good food, he likes good meat. He can't support that habit. He steals from his parents. So it begins with them. And the halacha states that if his parents are mochel, if they forgive him, he stole from them, they forgive him. So then the whole thing never gets off the ground. He will not become a ben sora umora. Which is interesting, because that means in order to, yes, become a ben sora umora, he has to have stolen from his parents, and his parents do not forgive him, and are prepared to bring him to Beis Din and see him be stoned. So that itself is quite unlikely. If his parents forgive him, the mochel, he doesn't become a ben sora umora. Except, what's very interesting about this halacha is a question that is raised by the Shemi Shmuel, Sokachov Rebbe. And that is, why should it be that if his parents forgive him, then he doesn't get the designation of a ben sora umora? The background to the question is, at the end of the day, the reason why he's put to death is nothing to do with his parents. Not really. It begins with them. As Rashi famously quotes from Chazal, that we're worried that he's on a downward slide, and it begins with stealing from his parents, but he has addictive habits, and they're expensive, and when his parents' money runs out, so then he'll turn to other people, and if they're not forthcoming, anything could happen. He will not stop short of anything, including bloodshed. Interestingly, we may have mentioned in the past, Rav Moshe Feinstein's Zatzal, in this Chubas Igwas Moshe, someone wrote him a Shaila with regards to the question of drugs. What is that? What is the halachic position of drugs? And are they categorically also? So, of course, the instant answer is they're also because they're damaging to health and the nishmatim le'odanach shaseichim. But Rav Moshe then added that there's much room to say that the isser of getting involved in that sort of thing is essentially an application of the concept of ben sora umora. Because as we know, unfortunately, maisim b'chol yom, that these things are expensive, they're addictive, the person will stop at nothing to get the money to finance them, including drug-related murders are a regular feature in the news. So it's very interesting to lift what seems to be a rather old-fashioned, so to speak, aveira, and bring it into the 20th century, and of course from there to the 21st century. And the reason why we mention all of this is because, since at the end of the day, the reason why he has such a drastic sentence, he's put to death, is because we're looking to protect him from becoming a murderer. So then what's it got to do with his parents? I mean, it's begun with them, but seemingly everything that we're worried about will happen even if they are mochel, because they're just hakofa number one. But we're worried about Hakafas number 6 and 7, which will end the bloodshed. We don't wish to reach a situation where he ends up having these habits, and he kills someone, and then they ask, you know, didn't anyone see this earlier on? Isn't this a classic Ben Sera Umura? And we say, well, yeah, but his parents were Mochel. So then whatever's meant to happen, whatever is suspected will happen, ends up happening. So how have we protected the issue of Ben Sera Umura? That's the interesting Shaila. Because, once again, to be clear on the question, it begins with him stealing from his parents, but it's not really about them in the end. So how can it stop with them being mochel him? Everything else is going to spiral out of control regardless. But in a sense, that leads us to another question. We're quite, it seems, pessimistic about the Ben Sera Umura. We look at him and we say, this will end in bloodshed. So much so, we're prepared to, at least theoretically, we're prepared to put an end to it now by putting an end to him. I mean, that we basically don't really hold out much hope that there will be a reversal, which is interesting because one may ask, do we not see in life that there are many people, they can be leading a very destructive lifestyle for a long time and they turn around at a certain point. How come we don't seem to hold out much hope that he will turn around? We're almost resigned to the fact, or it's confirmed, that he will end up that way. And these are the two questions of the Shemesh Shmuel, and he gives a very fascinating approach to the whole idea of Ben Sera Umura, and as we'll see, it extends beyond the concept of this particular mitzvah. The Shemesh Shmuel says, it is true, and of course we're leading up to the season of Tshuva, it is true that any person can undergo a reversal at any time. Except the question is, where does that reversal come from? After all, Newton's law of physics should, in principle, apply to spiritual direction as well. If something is moving in a certain direction, it will continue unless it's opposed by another force and stopped and then reversed. So from where comes the reversal if he's heading in a destructive trail? The answer, says Shemesh Shmuel, as we know, and there's much to discuss about it, is that there's within the Jew that is capable of expressing itself at any time, that inner essence, that pure soul, and you never know when it may make its appearance and turn everything around. And that's where it comes from. As we see, the most unlikely people to have come back to Torah, that's where it comes from, buried there, and then it finds its time and expresses itself. However, says Shemesh Shmuel, if we ponder further and ask, what is the nature of this essence, what we call the essence of the Jew, where does it come from? The answer is, it comes from the others. Should we ask, what's the difference between the nature of the Jewish people and the nature of the nations of the world? We have the others, and they didn't. We can brag about our past. They are not our achievements. We're the heirs of the achievements of the others. And that's why we say in the morning, Ashreinu, Atochakenu, Manoim Goraleinu, Umayofa Yerushaseinu, how wonderful is our inheritance. The inheritance of the Beis Halevi they were referring to is that we have inherited the stellar, exalted qualities of the Avos. What they worked so hard to instill within themselves became instilled within their descendants. We've mentioned in the past, worthwhile mentioning again, the Mishnah, two Mishnahs actually, in Pirkei Avos, in Perek Hei, which talk about Avram Avinu. The first one talks about the 10 generations, from Noach to Avram, Asar Adoros. It's in that list of 10. And then the next Mishnah is the 10 Nisyonos, the 10 trials of Avram. And the way the Mishnah expresses itself is very interesting. In the first Mishnah, which is about the 10 generations, it says, Asar Adoros mi Noach va'ad Avraham. Okay. The second Mishnah says, Asar Nisyonos nisnasa Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu was tried with 10 trials. So the question, as Rav Chaim of Elojin in the Perush Ruach Chaim and Pirkei Avos asks, is this seems to be counter to the way people are normally introduced. Normally, when you first mention them, that's when you say what there is to say about them. And then you can proceed on first name terms, so to speak, or to without the titles. Which means the first Mishnah should have introduced him as Avram Avinu. And having introduced him, the second Mishnah can then talk about him as Avram. In the event, it was the opposite. The first Mishnah calls him Avram, and all of a sudden in the second Mishnah, he's Avram Avinu. How did that expand? That's not the norm. However, says Reb Chaim, the answer is because there's something about the content of the second Mishnah that the Avraham Avinu is of the essence. And the reason why is because the first Mishnah is about Avram's greatness, from Noach to Avram. That's one thing. But the second Mishnah begins to talk about the trials of Avram. And there's something we need to appreciate about those trials. And Reb Chaim illustrates, and he gives an example. You can have someone, he's living comfortably in Chutz La'aretz, he's doing well, and one day he gets it into his head, he's moving to Eretz Yisrael. And this is Reb Chaim of Voloshin talking in the 1800s, where moving anywhere was not an easy thing, and certainly moving to Eretz Yisrael was a great, involved a great deal. But people did it. And Reb Chaim says, you know, you may wonder, where did that come from? Where it came from was Avraham Avinu had an Nisayon called Lech Lecha. He had his own trial to come and live in Eretz Canaan. And he overcame whatever he needed to overcome. He took the trip. And in so doing, he then instilled within his nature and the nature of his descendants an inclination towards, an affinity towards Eretz Yisrael. There are other people in times of adversity, they accept it gracefully, even though in normal times they're not that graceful at all. But difficult things happen and they accept it, they say it's Min HaShamayim. Where does it come from, says Reb Chaim? They are heirs to the Nisayon of Avram when he did all good things, and there's a famine in the land. And that's one of the tests. And what is the test? And how do you pass the test? You pass the test by the grace with which you accept it and the trust with which you have that it's all for the best and you do what needs to be done. And these people are heirs. And so it is with all of the Nisyonos, up to Pikuach Nefesh itself, which Avram underwent first in Ur Kasdim and later on with Yitzchak at the Akedah. And therefore, all of the qualities, the inherently good qualities of the Jewish people, they are the legacy, they are the inheritance of the Avos. But because that's true, and here there's a fascinating point here. So but just to conclude, that's why, says Reb Chaim of Voloshin, the first Mishnah talks about him as Avram, because he's Avram the person. But the second Mishnah, which begins to talk about the Nisyonos, he's called Avram Avinu, because with each Nisayon, as Avinu, we then receive that quality as well. But if the qualities, says Shem Yishmuel, are the product of the Avos, so he understands that each person doesn't receive these qualities as a package, self-contained, that he can then take wherever he goes, whatever he does. Rather, they are an ongoing, the result of an ongoing connection. There is a line that is established between the Avos and the descendants. And because that line is established, he's constantly receiving these qualities with the Avos to whom he is connected. And because that's where the qualities are dependent upon that connection, it's possible for a person to lose those qualities. He can lose those qualities if he severs the connection. And this is really a fascinating way of understanding the importance really of relating to earlier generations, beginning with one's own parents. There's so much to say about the mitzvah of Kibbud Av. It's basically Hakaras HaTov, and it's so many other things. But apart from anything else, it is a person establishing a connection with the generation that came before, and through that to all the generations who came before that, back until the Avos. And as long as that connection is open, so then those qualities are available, and he can tap into them, and they can be activated through him. And that is why, says Shem Yishmuel, we are clearly so pessimistic in the case of the Ben Sora Umura. He's not just, quote-unquote, someone who's doing the wrong thing, because people do the wrong thing and then they come to do the right thing. Why is there no hope for him? Why is there no optimism for him? Because the force which should generate the move to reverse, to turn things around, is the connection with the Avos. But he's severed his connection with the Avos, because his relationship with them is only to steal money from them in order to support his habits. And therefore, the rupture of his relationship with his parents, it's not just the first in a series of wrongdoings. It severs a connection from which his recovery could come. And that's why the Torah says it's got to end here. That itself is fascinating. But that brings us to the further point, and that is, says Shem Yishmuel, now we understand why everything changes if his parents forgive him. Because if his parents forgive, our question was, well, if his parents forgive him, that's very nice, but you know, he's still gonna do all those things. Why are we not so worried that he will be on this downward spiral? The answer is Shemesh, well, because if his parents forgive him, they've reopened thereby the channel between them and him. He turned it off, they're turning it on again. And therefore, once that channel is open, we revert to our default optimism that as someone with a channel open to his parents and back to the obvious themselves, there's always the hope that there will be a reversal. So this is truly a wonderful approach to Ben Sora Omorah. Much to learn, as we said, not only about the Ben Sora Omorah, who we're likely never to meet, or at least we hope we never meet them, not as a child and not grown up, but beyond in terms of the very nature of the Jewish people themselves and the important relationships between the generations. A little bit further on in the Parsha, we have the mitzvah of Kansipor, the famous the bird nest. And that's in Perek Kaf Beis, Pasuk Vav. And the Pasuk reads, Ki yikarei Kansipor lefanecha, if you should happen upon a bird's nest, laderech, when it's on the way, b'chol eitz, or la'aretz, in a tree or on the ground, Efrochim obeitzim, you have these young birds or eggs even, va'imer vetzes alo efrochim, or labeitzim, the mother is hovering over them, lo tikacha em alabonim, you can't take them together, rather shalech to shalach esaim, besabonim, tikachlach, send the mother away, and then you can take the young. That's the mitzvah of Shiloach HaKen. I'm reminded a number of years ago, I was one of my weekly sessions with Rav Kupperman, my uncle, Zichron Levracha. He told me there was a time when the kids were young and it was all getting a bit much, and he kind of felt that he didn't need a break, but he felt his wife needed a break. So he sent her on vacation and he kept the kids home. And there he was taking care of them, his wife, he sent away for a few days, Rebbetzin, and someone met him and says, you know, all your kids are with you. And he says, yes, I sent my wife on vacation. He said, where'd you get the idea from? So Rav Kupperman says, It's in Chumash Devarim. It's a mitzvah in the Torah. The Torah says, Shaleach tishalach et ha'em. Et ha'banim tikach lach. Send the mother away. Take the children with you. And that's his way of fulfilling the mitzvah. So there is a very interesting discussion, rather unusual in fact, with regards to the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen. The halachas are discussed in the end of Maseches Chulin. The final chapter is about Shiluach HaKen. And the Gemara there asks the question in the Kuf Lamed Tes Amud Beis. Sha'alu Paponoi, the people of Paponia, that's a certain place there, and they asked Rav Masna as follows. See, the background to the question is, the Torah says that the bird's nest, I mean, where is it? What are our parameters here? B'chol eitz, it could be in a tree, o ala aretz, or on the ground. Either in a tree or on the ground. So here's a shaila. Matzah kein geroshav shel adam. What if there's a bird's nest on a person's head? Mahu. Now what? And the background to their question is that, well, it's not a tree, okay. But is it called ba'aretz? Because it's not directly on the ground, it's actually on someone's head. Okay, so there you go, the question's out. Just in case you were wondering, is everything discussed in the Gemara? Now you know. Omar, so to this, Rav Masna replied with a quotation, the Adama al Rosho. And there was earth on his head. Where are those words from, and how do they help the Jewish people? Well, In the Sefer Shmuel, in Shmuel Beis, actually in Perek Tes Vav, it discusses the rebellion of Absalom, and he was garnering his support and his team, and David was on the run, and one of those psukim, Pasuk Lamed Beis of Perek Tes Vav, describes someone who came to meet him, someone called Hushai Ha'arki. V'hinei likraso, Hushai Ha'arki, who was one of his sympathizers, one of his friends. Karua kutanto, his clothes were torn as an act of commiseration with David, the hard times that David was going through. Va'adama al rosho, and there was earth on his head. Now, what are we meant to miss? Rashi explains what the Gemara means to establish here is that even, after all, what is Adama is earth. But Adama is the earth, as Aretz is the earth. If it's on someone's head, there's room to say it's soil, it's afar, but it's no longer Adama, because it's no longer on the ground. Yet here we see that even though it was on his head, this soil was on his head, it's called Adama. And the moral of the story is, even soil that's on someone's head is still called Adama. Now we know it's not considered detached. Interestingly, I mean, this whole scenario for us, I don't know what to say, the expression strictly for the birds comes to mind, but there's a fascinating comment of the Aruch HaShulchan in Yeridea, because the Shulchan Aruch paskens it. It's in the Gemara, paskens the Shulchan Aruch. Bird's nest on someone's head, there you go. The good news is, there's a mitzvah of Shiloh HaKen. The bad news is, the person has a bird's nest on his head. Okay. But the Aruch HaShulchan says, you know, this seems to be rather unlikely. How would this scenario ever come about? However, you should know, and I don't know how the Aruch HaShulchan knows this, but it's corroborated by other sources as well, that in India, there are certain mystics or hermits who have as their life's goal, in order to completely, shall we say, detach themselves from physical living, etc., they undergo a process whereby they don't move. That's their mission in life, is to stay completely still. And moreover, says Aruch HaShulchan, it is reported that they are capable of staying still for so long that over time, dirt begins to collect on them and the birds begin to nest on their heads. And therefore, says Aruch HaShulchan, in case you're wondering, for whose benefit is the Gemara asking this question? Of course, we have no idea who the Paparnai and what the Minhagim were at that time. Apparently, it's an old Minhag. Other sources take it back to certain schools of philosophy within Greece. And therefore, these people also need the Halacha Paskin for them. And they need other help also, but they need the Halacha Paskin for them. So that's the Halacha. The question is, beyond Shiloh HaKen, where does this leave us? There is a very interesting discussion which takes place in the Sefer Chaye Adam, which, as we know, is one of the classics on the Aruch Chaim section of Shulchan Aruch. A question in Hilchos Brachos. And that is, as we know, anything that grows from the ground, or most things that grow from the ground, vegetables, the bracha on them is Barei Pri Hadam. What happens if something is growing in soil, but it's not directly attached to the ground? That is to say, it is detached, it's in a container, and the container is entirely not porous. So it's completely detached, but it is soil. And the vegetables basically grow merrily there. In our time, of course, this is a whole industry. There are platforms which are elevated, they're not exactly on the ground, and sometimes they're completely detached in that way. What is the bracha on a vegetable that grows in soil detached from the ground? Is it yet hadama or not? And the Chaye Adam's halachic conclusion is those vegetables, the bracha is shahakol, not bari pri hadama. And the reason why, says the Chaye Adam, is because in order to make the bracha bari pri hadama, this vegetable needs to have grown from the ground. And the definition of ground is soil that is attached to the earth. But if it's detached, it's soil, but it's not the ground. And therefore, you cannot make a bracha bari pri hadama. Now, most of the discussion takes place, revolves around the Yerushalmi in the seven. I get into that discussion. But in the course of his comments, he brings a proof from our Gemara. How? From the bird's nest on the person's head. How so? Because, says the Chaye Adam, let's remind ourselves, the Gemara wanted to know, if there's a bird's nest on the person's head, is that called Ba'aretz or not, because it's detached? It's not directly on the ground, it's on his head. And the answer, said the Gemara, comes from the words, with Chushai Ha'arki, the Adama Arosho. It's still called Adama, even though it's on his head. But why, says Chaye Adam, don't forget that Rashi explains the reason why it's still called Adama is because it's on a person, and the person himself is called Adama. Adam is called Adama, and therefore it's still considered to be connected. It's almost like extended soil, extended earth, that is to say. You have Mother Earth, and then you have honorary earth in the form of the person, and then you have the bird nest, but it's called on Adama. Says the Chaya Adam, if that's how Rashi explained that it's still considered to be the earth, because the person is earth, and it's still connected, the implication is if it's completely disconnected, it's no longer considered earth. It's just soil. It's just afar, and therefore, in our case, if the vegetables grow in a way which is completely disconnected from the earth, they are not called pri ha'adama, and the bracha should be shahakal. So that's a fascinating comment, psak, of the Chay Adam. If we may say, it deduces a proof from afar. However, we should know, there are those who argue and say that even those vegetables that grow in this detached environment, this detached surface, the bracha should still be ha'adama. And there are two reasons for this. Number one is that as long as there's soil there, it could be that even if the soil is detached, it's still called ha'adama. And the reason why is because back to the Gemara in Chulin, with the bird's nest on the person's head, although Rashi explained that it's called adama because the person himself is adama, other Rishonim, the Ritva, for example, states very simply that even though it's on its head, it's still called Aretz and doesn't go into the whole thing that a person's like Adama, etc. He just said, although it's a bit removed, it's still called Aretz. And therefore, according to that approach, the Gemara actually proves the opposite of what the Chaya Adam is saying. Namely, even if it's detached, it's still called Adama. And therefore, even if the soil is detached, the bracha should still be Ha'adama. Another reason why they maintain that the bracha should be ha'adama is because it could be that the brachas, we don't need to trace the history of this particular vegetable when deciding what bracha to make, but rather it's a species thing, it's a categorical thing, and therefore as a category, vegetables are pri-ha'adama. It could be that the destiny of this vegetable did not originate with attached to the ground, but it nonetheless belongs to a species that in principle grows from the ground, and in general grows from the ground, and therefore as a categorical definition, even if it's detached, it's still called pri-ha'adama. Interestingly, just as a PS here, it seems that the primary reason for saying ha'adama is the first reason. Even if the earth is detached, it's still called ha'adama. Not the second reason, that it's about species. And the reason why I mention this is because it's possible to generate a vegetable with no soil at all. And that is the whole enterprise which is known as hydroponics, gidulei mayim, whereby there's nutrients and etc. There's no soil at all. And now, should we ask vegetables that are grown, and there are vegetables that are grown there, certain sprouts and shoots and cucumbers also, I believe, and a few others, what bracha would one make? So here we'll appreciate that if there are two reasons for making ha'adama when the soil is detached, only one of them will apply. If the reason for making ha'adama when the soil is detached is detached soil is still called ha'adama, that's only applicable when there's actually soil, which is not the case if there's only water and those nutrients. But if we say it's about the category, it remains true that even though there's no soil at all, these are pri ha'adama. But the preponderance of the poskim seems to be that if a person knows for sure that these were hydroponically grown, he should make the bracha shehakol. Because if there's no soil at all, there's no ha'adama at all. That's only true, of course, if he happens to know. It's very difficult to know. I don't think they advertise on the packaging, and therefore all things seem equal. If you don't know, so then you default back to ha'adama. So this, it's very fascinating to see how what begins with such an obscure question of the bird's nest on the person's head has its own contribution to potentially halacha lemaisa, and things could change as more and more of these things are grown in water. Perhaps the halachas themselves will need to take that into account, but that's enough from there for the time being. Now, we mentioned that there's a number of mitzvahs, many mitzvahs, in fact, in Parshas Ki Tzeitse. It's true. Some of those mitzvahs are rather gritty in nature. They deal with relationships and things that go wrong. And therefore, we don't normally reference them. But there is actually one mitzvah which I saw as a certain discussion. It begins there, but once again, a great deal to learn far beyond there. And that's to be found in Perek Kaf Gimel, Pasuk Yud Tes. Perek Kaf Gimel, Pasuk Yud Tes. And the pasuk reads, "Lo tzavi esnon zona u'mechir kelev beis Hashem elokecha l'chol neder." So there are certain things here that are disqualified as korbanos. A person brings an animal for a korban. What type of thing could disqualify? A number of things. If it has a blemish, and here are a couple of other things. If it has a tainted history. And what are the examples here, or the two categories here? Esnon zona, which I believe the polite expression for this is a harlot's hire. That this was the form in which he compensated for that act. And here's this animal, and now someone has the bright idea to bring it as a korban. And the Torah says, you can't bring it as a korban. Nor, mechir kelev, the person exchanged a dog for this sheep, that sheep is no longer acceptable for a korban. Well, if we ask the question, going back for a moment to Esnan Zona, and again, as you can appreciate, this is not a topic which is discussed at Sheva Brach as much, but, and ask the Shaila, why? What's wrong? Well, the answer would seem to be immediately forthcoming. After all, it's got such a sullied history. It's in the height of bad taste, as the pasuk itself says. Kito avas Hashem elokecha gam shnehem. These are abominations. They're born of a forbidden act, and therefore, it's not acceptable as a korban. That's the Torah draws the line, with all due respect, or the lack thereof. And that's really how, on a very straightforward level, how certain Mefarshim explain. The Ibn Ezra says it's a bizayon to have such an animal, and Rambam similarly in the Mor Nevuchim in Chelek Gimel Perek Memvav. However, there is an approach to understanding why this animal, this Esnan Zona, the Torah disqualifies it as a korban. And it is mentioned in the writings of the Ramban, Perush of the Ramban. Ramban states, Hazonos yasu be'esnon shelahem. So here's the zona. She's received this as compensation, and she wants to do a mitzvah with it. Choshvos lechaper al chatoson, thinking that thereby she will get kapara for her sin, atonement for her sin, as if to say, in order to assuage her conscience, him or her, that they've done something wrong, but all's well that ends well. And it's okay, because the compensation, which is took the form of an animal, so bring it as a korban, and then it all works out in the end. Says Ramban, V'lachach asra Torah eston nechol neder. That's why the Torah asked it. Why? Ki ato yusifu lachto bahen. Because it will only encourage more sin. In other words, if this is an ongoing way of alleviating any pangs of conscience, it's fine because she's bringing it as a korban, and then one can go weiter. So that will actually encourage a continuation of that behavior. In other words, the difference between the approach of Ibn Ezra and Rambam on the one hand, and Ramban on the other, as to understanding why it's disqualified. For Ibn Ezra and Rambam, it's disqualified because of where it comes from. But according to Ramban, it's disqualified because of what it will lead to. And in fact, aside from anything else, according to the Ramban, this is the antithesis of what a korban is. Because a korban, from the word karov, is meant to bring a person closer to Hashem. This animal used as a korban will perpetuate the distance between that person and Hashem. Because by bringing a korban, the thought is that this will allow for the ongoing reprehensible behavior. And therefore, the moral of the story is, sometimes things are disqualified if they're, not only will they not make things better, they'll allow them to continue being worse. And it's very interesting to see how this dovetails into a comment of the Kli Yakar in the beginning of Chumash Vayikra. There, of course, the beginning of Vayikra, most of Vayikra, but certainly the beginning, is about korbanos, again. And the pasuk begins with the word Adam, as we know. Adam ki yakriv mikem. And Rashi comments, why is the Torah emphasizing Adam bringing a korban? And Rashi has an amazing comment that's from the Chazal, and that is, in order for a korban to be kosher, you've got to be like Adam. In what way? So Rashi says, you know what's interesting about Adam HaRishon? Everything he brought was his. Everything around him was his, because he was the only person. And your korban has to be like that. Meaning, Adam sets the standard for korban bringing. As surely as he didn't bring anything that was stolen, because there wasn't anyone from whom to steal, similarly, you can't bring a korban min hagezel, from something that's stolen, because then you're not like Adam anymore. It's a very interesting way of the Torah communicating the idea that a stolen korban is disqualified. And once again, we seem to be back in the same situation. Why would a person bring a stolen korban? Well, they might think, if as much as I've stolen it, which is one could say is morally a gray area, but I'm bringing it as a korban, and therefore it has a good ending. In which case, maybe all's well that ends well, it's all okay. What's interesting is, and thus far as from Rashi, the Kliyakar in Vayikra there notes that we may perhaps understand that what Rashi means to say, a person who stole an animal, that animal is disqualified. But the Kliyakar says, Rashi didn't say that you can't bring min hagazul, from something that's stolen. He says you can't bring min hagezel, from stealing. What's the difference between min hagazul, something that's stolen, and min hagezel, from stealing? The point is, says Kliyakar, what the Torah is looking to disqualify here and to warn people about, not that he stole an animal and then brought it as a korban. What's in it for him? No. Rather, it's about a person who's involved in gezel. He steals money. He steals a lot of money. And now the question is, so what should I do? Should I stop stealing? But rather, he says, you know, if I take some of that money and I buy a korban with it, so that's almost like my miser for my stealing. And that makes everything okay, because I've represented the cause with my stolen money. And once again, the point is that such a person, through bringing that korban, it's a constant way of alleviating any kind of feelings of guilt, which allows him to continue stealing. And that's why the Torah said that anything from gezel is disqualified. The response to stealing isn't bringing the korban. It's to stop stealing and to give it back. And this matter is discussed in a very wonderful sefer, which we have not yet had occasion to quote from a Talmud Chacham who lives here in Yerushalayim. His name is Rav Michal Fodor. Fodor, yeah. F-O-D-O-R. And his sefer, Mimini Michael. And he discusses this question. And he quotes, he doesn't mention anyone's name, but a fascinating maisa that happened with a certain Rosh Hashiva. And the yeshiva was in dire financial straits. So far, there's nothing unusual about this story. But then he received an offer for help from someone who was known not really to be the best in terms of their Torah and mitzvah, someone who's quite a bit lacking, but who would like to make a contribution. And the Rosh Hashiva refused. And the reason why he refused is he says, I do not wish for my yeshiva to be an accessory to an avera. So that was a bit of an unusual thing to hear, because as far as everyone's concerned, if he gives a donation, it's an accessory to a mitzvah, not an accessory to an avera. He said, no, this person knows he should be doing better. He doesn't want to do better. So what is if for his conscience, he says, if he gives a contribution to the yeshiva, that will maintain his lifestyle. And I don't wish to be a party to that, because on the contrary, by the fact that he takes some of his money, and who knows where it comes from and what else that he's up to, should you say to him, maybe you should perhaps reconsider your life track. He says, what do you mean? You didn't see my plaque on the wall. I'm in the yeshiva. I'm good. I'm set. And therefore, I do not wish to be the reason why he continues to in that way. He should do a cheshbon nefesh and maybe a repair from within. And the fascinating concluding point, which is really leaves a great deal of room for thought, is that this is possible even within the realms of tshuva. In other words, as far as we're concerned, tshuva, once again, is the happy ending. That a person does tshuva, he gets kapara, what could be better? That's what everyone hopes for. However, says Rav Fodor, it's possible for that tshuva itself can be abused in this way. As if to say, a person reaches a certain point, and maybe it's close to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and he's weighed down by sin. He's overburdened by sin. He can't bear it. But he doesn't mind having a few. He can't have too many on his shoulders, but he doesn't mind having a few in his pocket. So what does he do? He has a way out. He can do tshuva and get kapara. That gives him a clean slate. Now that it gives him a clean slate, so he can pick up a few again. Not too many. And this is the other side of the coin of the famous discussion that the Gemara had, or the Mishnah even. Where the Mishnah says if a person sins with the intention that he'll do tshuva afterwards. That's a famous Mishnah in the end of Maseches Yuma. Ha'omer, echta ha'oshuv, echta ha'oshuv. He's got it all worked out. It's a whole plan. Stage one, he'll sin. Stage two, he'll do tshuva, and it's all worked out. So the Mishnah says, tshuva is not such a straightforward thing for that person anymore. And the reason why is because tshuva is the source of his sin. He's only sinning because he's relying on tshuva. That's not acceptable. Here, we're discussing something which has the same result. It comes here, the sin isn't what leads to... He doesn't do sin with doing tshuva in mind. He does tshuva with sinning in mind. And really, the moral of the story here is that the gift of tshuva, it has a certain achrayus. It should not be abused, because it might not work. To abuse it means that it's used in the service of sin. But authentic and responsible tshuva is that it's used in the interest of avoiding sin. And this brings us back to Esnan Zona, and brings us back to a korban from Gezel, and that's certainly something I believe well worth thinking about. So as we said, from rather humble beginnings in terms of the pasuk itself, a great deal to ponder with regards to these matters. Well, I'd like to move from here to a section at the end of the parsha, in the beginning of Perek Kafhe. As always in Kiseitse, we'll be, by definition, missing out almost everything. So the beginning of Perek Kafhe is about, deals with the question of Malkus. As we know, there are a certain sins, in fact it's so to speak the default for a sin that involves an action, if it's been Odom Lamokum, the punishment for that's the rule, is that he'll get Malkus. And that's described in Pasuk Beis, Perikate Pasuk Beis. V'haya im bin hakus ha-rasha, if he's someone who's deserving of Malkus, the shofet, he stoops him over and he administers Malkus. Kedei rishaso b'mispar, and keep in accordance with his wrongdoing. B'mispar, with the number of arboim yakenu lo yosif, 40, but no more. And the pasuk concludes, v'nikla achicha le'einecha. And your brother shall be demeaned before you. And that's also part of it. But amazingly, in those final words, v'nikla achicha le'inecha, which is really the result of what happens in Malkus, there is a silver lining. If you look at Rashi, it's such a positive way of looking at these words. V'nikla achicha, says Rashi, kol hayom kareo Rasha. The pasuk has called him Rasha the whole time. But umishalaka, but now that he's received Malkus, he's your brother. He's back. Umishalacha kro achicha. As if to say, he did what he shouldn't have done. Beis Din did what it needed to do. But he's back. It's reparative. It's not just punitive in the way that's the end of him. It's to bring him back. And he comes back. He's your brother. Just give him an aliyah again in shul. Lis psicha. What's interesting is, the Gemara states, and this is the halacha, that even if a person violated a sin where the punishment is kores, which is death by the hands of heaven, if he receives malchus, he gets kapara, and the whole thing is lifted. Even chayvei krisus, through malchus, he can get kapara. very interesting to make historical note. It was a major move in the early 1500s in Sfat to restore the process of smicha. Smicha, that is to say, what was meant to be the unbroken chain of smicha, transmission and ordination from Moshe Rabbeinu onwards. It was broken in the times of the Gemara, and it is possible, some maintained, that according to the Rambam, it can be jump-started. It can be restarted. And the way that happens is if all of the Chachamim get together, they, in a sense, they have the latent power of the Sanhedrin, and they can bestow smicha on one person, and then he can then is now a musmach and can bestow smicha on others. This was the movement which took place in Sfat, which involved the Rebbe of the Beis Yosef, Rebbe Yosef Karo's Rebbe, the Maribe Rav, and other Chachamim of Sfat. It was famously controversial because it all took place in Sfat, and it was Yerushalayim was not consulted, which elicited a very harsh response from the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, the Maharal Bach, Rabbi Nulevi Ibn Chabib, who says, you know, the Rambam says, first of all, I'm not convinced that it works anyway, says Maharal Bach, but even if it does, didn't the Rambam say that all the Chachamim should be involved? There's a lot of Chachamim in Sfat. Aren't there also some in Yerushalayim? No one was invited, no one was consulted. It was a whole thing, and there's a great deal to discuss, which we have in the past, and Mitzvah Hashem can do in the future. The reason why I mention it here is because it's not so well known. What was the impetus for restarting Smicha? As if to say, you know, it had lain dormant for so long. Since the time of the Gemara, which is already, you know, the 300 or 400s, it's over 1,000 years, and all of a sudden, seemingly, there was this push to restart Smicha. From what I've understood, a large part of that push came from people who had been expelled from Spain, from the Anusim. And this is the early 1500s, and a lot of them made their way to Eretz Yisrael, and in the Galil there, and in Tzfat. And the reason why they were so insistent or anxious that Smicha should be reinstituted is because a lot of them had led lives which involved violating prohibitions that carry with them the Issur of Kares. And they were anxious for the Sanhedrin, or for the Smicha to start. Why? Because Malkus only has the status of such if it is administered by people who are considered a Bezdin, who have Smicha, and they wanted to receive Malkus in order to expiate their Kares. It was a grassroots movement. In that way. That's a fascinating parsha all on its own. But the reason why I mention this matter, and again, to be clear where we are, Rashi says, you see, once he's received Malkus, he's like your brother again, and the Mishnah says, even if he did something that makes him liable for a kares, he could still become like your brother again by getting Malkus. The question is, how do we know? How do we know that these words, he's like your brother again, apply even to such a severe sin that carries the penalty of kares? And I would like to suggest that at least one answer to this question, wherein these words do we see the penalty of kares, can also be undone based on the Medrash in Shir HaShirim. As we know, many psukim in Shir HaShirim are taken by Chazal as a reference to Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's why there is a widespread minhag to read Shir HaShirim on Seder night, because it's all about Yetzias Mitzrayim, Hinei Hastav Avar, etc. It's time for the spring. And one of those psukim, Hashem says, as we know from the Shir HaShirim, Kumilach Achosi. He calls the Jewish people Achosi, my sister. And the Medrash Yerushalayim called them my sister. He was telling them to fulfill the mitzvahs of Korban Pesach and Mila. As we know, they were the two primary mitzvahs in whose merit we left. So that comes from Achosi. Because they're called Achosi, that translates into the mitzvahs of Pesach and Mila. The question is, how does Achosi got to do with Pesach and Mila? How does one lead to the other? Where's the connection here? Reuven Margolius, in his Perush on the Haggadah Shel Pesach, which is entitled Be'er Miriam, explains, the word Achos has two meanings in Lashon HaKodesh. On the one hand, the word achos means sister. Ach, achos, brother, sister. But also, and of course connected, but also the word achos means to attach something, to reconnect something. Le'achot et hakera, if something has been torn or ruptured, to bring it back together again, is called ichui. It's called le'achos. Aha. So, Rabbi Reuven Margolyer says, now that we have the full connotation of the word achos, achos means to keep things connected and not ruptured. So you know what's interesting about Pesach and Mila? They are the two mitzvahs where the neglect of that mitzvah leads to kares, as we know. Very severe. That's unusual. Normally it's transgression of certain losases that could lead to kares. Never neglect of a positive mitzvah. But these two are exceptions, as we see in the Psukim, in the Chumash, and the penalty for neglect in those two mitzvahs is kares. There's a Ruvim Margolios. So if these two mitzvahs carry with them the penalty of kares, which is disconnect, then the fulfillment of that of those mitzvahs allows for the continuation of the connection. That's called achosi. That's called le'achos, to connect things. And that's how Chazal and Medrash Shira Shirim Rabbah understand from the word achosi the references to the mitzvahs of Pesach and Mila, two connectors. Well, based on the comment of Rabbi Margolios, perhaps you may suggest that this is what lies in the statement of the Mishnah, that even if a person violated a transgression that has the penalty of kares, if he gets malchus, it can be atoned for. Where does it come from? V'nikla achicha le'enecha. That word again, achicha, as if to say, in the same way that in the Medrash Shir HaShirim, achos refers to mitzvahs whose neglect would lead to kares and whose performance avoids it, so too, achicha within the context of malchus allows that connection to be reinstated, even if it was ruptured through a liability of kares. So from the word achicha, we see with its connective connotation, we see that even kares, where it's disconnected, can be reconnected through the malchus. That's a suggestion. But let's conclude by referring to the number of malchus. As we know, if you look at the pasuk, you would be forgiven for getting the wrong halachic answer as to how many malchus are administered. The pasuk says, and Gimel, Arba'im Yakenu, Le'Yosef, he gets 40 malchus. We call it malchus Arba'im. 40 malchus. How many is 40? 40. As we know, the halacha is, he gets 39. And where does that come from? Well, it's complicated. It actually links the beginning of Pasuk Gimel to the end of Pasuk Beis. Because Pasuk Beis ends with the words b'mispar, with a number, which is a redundant word, because everything that has a number is a number. And the two words are brought together, b'mispar arba'im. The answer is no longer 40, it's the number of 40. And what is the number of 40? What does that mean? Now, for the Gemara explains that what it means to say is, it's the number that leads to 40, which is really 39. So we're in a very unusual situation here, because if you don't have such a fine vision of the Pasuk, you look at the Pasuk, you're going to get 40. But at the end of the day, it isn't 40. You have to be guided, and it's a bit more involved than that. By the time you finish, it's really 39. But nonetheless, the question remains, as the Maharal and the Gur Ari asked the question, if the answer is 39, isn't there an easier way to say it than rather say 40 and then put the number before it, which then leads to all sorts of involved thoughts? So as if to say, if the answer isn't 40, why does it look like it's 40? That's the question. And the Maharal gives a fascinating answer. And that is, the number 40, he quotes Ramban. Where does 40 come from? Mapitom 40. Ramban says that the 40 malchus, and we find often the significance of number 40, is because there are 40 days where the child is formed. Those are the first 40 days of pregnancy, where it goes from being just, liquid until something a chifsa, the 40 days of Yetzirah have lasted. And in a sense, each of the Malkus, says Ramban, is a strike for one of those 40 days. It represents the person. The person is represented by the number 40, and he gets 40 Malkus, as if to say, could do better. Now, what's interesting is, says Maharal, as we know, is that a person, certainly in those earlier stages, in the formative stages, it's mostly his physical matter that's being amassed and developed. But on the final day, day 40, here he gets his spiritual element. And then he's ready. There's still a good way to go, still a few trimesters to go, but in terms of the formative days, and really what that means is the breakdown of these 40 days is that 39 of those 40 days is pure physical development. Day 40 enters a spiritual element. And this now brings us back to the question of Malkus. Because the truth is, says Maharal, certainly the types of Averas that one gets Malkus for, they're a person who he follows his physical side too much. He crosses boundaries that should not be crossed, does things that should not be done. And that's really where the problem lies. The problem doesn't lie with his spiritual side. The problem lies with his physical side, and the spiritual side isn't strong enough or resolved enough to overcome it. Now, at the end of the day, there's no getting away from the fact that both components of the person were involved in the Avera. If he doesn't have life, he can't move, and therefore the act was done. No question about that. But if we ask the fundamental question, who's at fault? Not all 40 parts of the person are at fault. 39 are. One of them got brought along, and he contributes, but he's not where the problem lies. Moshel, the Maharal does not give this Moshel. I'm not sure if this is true in his time. I don't see why not. Very often, a teacher who sees a group of kids who have mamash gotten up to mischief can identify who are really the problems, and who are the hangers-on, and who are the innocent bystanders who are going to get swept up. And the reaction will differ, and rightly so. Whereas some of them need really a good dressing down, and they need the full force of the law to be brought against them. Others just need a bit of a talking to. And moreover, if they only shift them company, because that's really their problem. They're not bad kids. They fell into bad company. And that's fair. In a sense, the problem when a person does an avira is that his neshama has fallen into bad company, called his body, which represents 39 out of the 40. And therefore, the pasuk says, arba'im yakenu, because there are 40 parts of the person that were involved. But that, as true as that is, but then if you look deeper, you'll see that of those 40, 39 need a bit of a talking to in the form of Malkus. And when they're taken care of, the 40 is good to go. Because if the body only keeps itself in check, the soul only does good things. And thus you have this amazingly blended message whereby what meets the eye is 40. Because what meets the eye when the person does the Aveira is that all 40 are involved. But Chazal are Doresh. Look deeper, look closer. You'll see of those 40, 39 is the Malkus. When they get them, number 40 will be good by itself. And it's a fascinating idea, aside from anything else, because what it's doing is, as much as it's administering a punishment to the person for his behavior, at the same time, it is validating his essential being. As if to say, when he undergoes the process of Malkus, there's a message there. The message is, actions have consequences, but you are okay. That one part in 40 doesn't need Malkus, because you don't really need Malkus. The guf needs Malkus, and then the neshama is good to go. What a way to leave Beis Din. Not only having answered for his crime, but also received that message of encouragement in that way. We'll leave it over there.